Let's begin.
Everyone just gets here early.
The aim today is actually to get through paragraph 21, 22. However, we will spend the first hour on probably just on paragraph 9. And I've got 3 3/4 interpretations of paragraph 9. So we'll have a little bit to think about. Let me just catch up where we are. Last week discussed the disinterested character of pleasure, and I said the crux to the notion of disinterestedness is that the judgment of beauty, the object is an occasion of pleasure which bypasses the faculty of desire. And it's because it bypasses the faculty of desire, that is, the pleasure is not causally related to any antecedent desire, it's a disinterested pleasure. That was the argument we suffered over. And then we noticed that in paragraph 6, which is the beginning of the second moment, the judgment of taste as to its quantity, and the quantity is that it be of universal liking. That is, it's not either one or some, but always a universal pleasure. And one quick and dirty way to that universality we discovered was thinking of it just as an inference from disinterestedness, right? If my pleasure is not connected to any interest that is specific to me, that is, to my desires, and therefore to what distinguishes me from everyone else, if I have reasons to believe the pleasure is, in that sense, not mediated by an antecedent desire, then I have reason to believe that my judgment is universal. And this argument convinces absolutely no one. And it convinces no one because it's a negative argument, and it leaves out of account the possibility, right, that there's some other source of my attraction that is not either private to me or derived from a desire for the good, but say, because, oh, you know, why do men find Brigitte Bardot beautiful? I mean, that is what applies to a particular group of people, but not everyone, right, to some. And Kant really has no answer to that. He has no answer to that because he thinks of groups as logical extensions of private desire. So he doesn't have a way of distinguishing between my private desire for some object and what some particular subgroup, say, young adolescent males, find desirable. But we also saw that this is not so that Kant neglects the alternative that there may be some source that is neither unique to me nor universal but belonging to a collective. And hence, it seems reasonable to say that since Kant goes on to give a positive account of universality, he never meant it to be a rigorous inference. He only ever meant it to be a reasonable conclusion that builds a bridge, that is, disinterestedness builds a bridge to the normative aspects of the judgment of taste without fully making all the connections, and that therefore we need to look further to understand not merely a negative account, not interested, but a positive account of universality. And the rest of the second moment is dedicated to providing that positive account of universality. And that's where we finished last time. And in saying that, I did want to argue, or at least suggest, as a second step, really what's going on in paragraph 7, that what Kant is suggesting in paragraph 7 is that normativity belongs to the logical grammar of judgments of taste. It's what we mean by calling something beautiful rather than merely agreeable. So there's an implicit claim to universality just in the grammar. So he says at 2:13, that is why he says the thing is beautiful and does not count on other people. You want to close the door? It's a bit noisy out there. And he does not count on other people to agree with his judgment of liking on the ground that he has repeatedly found them agreeing with him. It's not an inductive judgment. It's not a judgment based on association or in reasonable past things. Rather, he demands that they agree. He reproaches them if they judge differently. I love that reproach. And denies that they have taste, which he nevertheless demands of them as something they ought to have. So clearly, yeah.
Just a quick question. Is this strictly for aesthetic judgment, or does this apply to judgment in general?
No, this is... we are here talking about just pure judgments of taste. And other forms of judgment are logically universal, and therefore we do require universality, but it's logical requirement based on the fact that the object comes under a concept. Now, Allison wants to distinguish universal validity, which he thinks is a quid facti, from the demand that others agree, a quid iuris. And while there's little hints of this in Kant, for example, at 2:16, I have questioned whether that distinction between universality as a mere logical category can be separated from universality as justificatory. So, at 2:16, Kant introduces the notion of the universal voice. He says, if we judge objects merely in terms of concepts, then we lose all presentation of beauty. This is why there can be no rule by which someone could be compelled to acknowledge that something is beautiful. So there's no conceptual or logical compulsion that can coerce someone to regard something as beautiful in the way you might compel them to regard something as a chair or a table or green or bright, or indeed as alive. No one can use reasons or principles to talk us into a judgment on whether some garment, house, or flower is beautiful. We want to submit the object to our own eyes, just as if our liking of it depended on that sensation. Notice, as if it depended on that sensation. Why doesn't it depend on that sensation? Well, the sensation is the subject.
Be interested.
Why would it be interested?
Depended on the sensation.
Not quite. Anyone else want to have a go? Well, pleasure would be the sensation. So we're beginning to broach the question of paragraph 9. Todd? If it's just the sensation, then it looks causal, right? It's as if it's the sensation, because it seems as if, so the puzzle, this is the puzzle, by the way, of paragraph 9. The puzzle is, I look at something, right, and I get this certain sensation, and I want to call it the object as a consequence of myself being in that sensory state, that pleasure. I want to say, it's beautiful. But if the sensation alone, as we're going to come back to in a moment, if it's the sensation alone that is the source of my judgment, then that's basing my judgment on a mere causal fact. I bumped into this Manet, whew, felt pleasure, said, boy, that's beautiful. But that sounds like now I'm just making a judgment based on something that's brought me something. What's gone missing in all that is judgment. This is going to be the puzzle. How we relate, the puzzle is going to be how we relate judgment and pleasure. That's the puzzle of paragraph 9. What we cannot do, although some naturalists wish to do this, what we cannot do, if we're going to be Kantian about this, is make the pleasure a mere causal fact about us that we then dress up into something like a rational claim. Which is, of course, what people do all the time. But that's irrational. So, but the reason... So the phrasing here is very careful. He says something about a judgment of taste is as if, as ob, our liking of it dependent on that sensation. It's like being in a sensory state, but somehow different. And we have to kind of open up that difference. And yet, now he's going on to get rid of the stuff he's not interested in. And yet, if we then call the object beautiful, we believe we have a universal voice. When I speak and I say it's beautiful, I take myself to be speaking for everyone. I, myself, standing right here in front of this painting and say it's beautiful, I take myself to be speaking for any creature who could put themselves in this position, right? Which is why people who are good at this, making aesthetic judgments, can feel as if they're coercing us, right? I mean, it feels oppressive, you know, that they speak with a universal voice. They're the, you know. But that's what it is to make an aesthetic judgment, to speak with a universal voice. It's not beautiful for me. It's beautiful for everyone. So when I speak, and therefore I lay claim to the agreement of everyone. And then he goes on to say, we can see at this point, nothing is postulated in a judgment of taste except such a universal voice. That is, nothing else is at stake. What really is at stake in calling it beautiful is that movement from my standing here as one individual facing an individual object with no concepts to rely on, and therefore no foundations or grounds or sources other than my capacity to judge. And on the basis of that alone, to say, it's beautiful, I speak for all of us. Humanity! That's what it is to make a judgment of taste. And nothing else is at stake, says Kant. Yeah.
Is there, I mean, because the Indian is always going to say, well, that begs the question. I mean, okay, you're giving me an argument based on the grammar, almost the group.
That's all we're doing is grammar at the moment. At the moment, what we're doing.
Are you going to give me anything else to prove to me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll give you a little bit. but it's important that Kant thinks that he's got something about the logical grammar here. That's why I want to underline this. That is, he thinks he's revealing to us how, if you wish, aesthetic talk operates and what its stakes are, and thereby what kinds of arguments and criticisms and other surrounding paraphernalia become appropriate. They kick in virtue of the original claim. Right? And again, the power of that claim is its, if you wish, groundlessness in conceptual terms, nothing but my taste, and its exorbitance in validity terms. I speak in a universal voice. And that's what makes it kind of uncanny. Now, in saying that, again, this is just bits of logical grammar for the moment. I am not, Kant says, postulating everyone's agreement. That is, I am not saying that if you stood in my shoes, you would say it is beautiful. Right? So I'm not making a prediction, to use the terms of Guire's first book, I am not making an ideal prediction of what the ideal situated perceiver would say. I am making a normative claim about what they ought to say. Right? It merely, he says, requires this agreement from everyone as an instance of a rule, an instance regarding which it expresses confirmation not from concepts, but from the agreement of others. That is, there, at the end of the day, and this is the other part that can drive you crazy, how do you know you got it right? Well, in part because others do agree with me. I mean, there's nothing like a proof structure here, so that the kind of evidence is going to be that it really does generate a community of agreement about this. But it does so not on the basis of a prediction, but on the basis of a normative requirement. That's why he says that the universal voice is only an idea. It's not a fact. It's what I require, demand of others. It's not a fact about the world. It's not a fact about me. It's not a fact about the object. It's to say that it is normative through and through. So I'm almost inclined to say, and I will say a little bit later, it's almost as if this is about the normativity of normativity. It's almost about as if this is getting at what it is to find ourselves capable of truly sharing our position as individuals with all others, not dependent on anything else. Say, the idea of the good. Yeah, that answers all the questions. Oh, yeah, it's the idea of the good. Don't need anything else. Call that the Platonic cheat. Now, it is equally obvious that although it is normative, it is not normative the way a moral norm is normative. It's not an imperative. I'm not saying that because I judge it as beautiful, you must say as I say, right? It doesn't have that kind of prescriptive force. So it's normative, strangely enough, and this is a tough idea of normativity, and I've never been able to hammer it down, I don't know if you have, it's normativity without prescriptivity. And that's another aspect of what might be at stake in calling it an idea. Something that ought to be realized, but something that we, and that's something we demand of others, but demand not in the way we demand that they don't kill their children or don't rob banks. It's a different kind of demand. Okay, so that brings us to paragraph 9. Let me stop there. I can see there's looks of bafflement all around the room. So, is there any way I can unleash this?
First thing you said tonight was about groups of logical extensions of friends desire.
Right.
So I'm not certain how normativity without prescriptivity is just.
Well, because it's got to be everyone. The claim is, I'm speaking with a universal voice. Now, I'm going to give a theory about what that means eventually. Okay, and it's a complicated theory, but I will give an account of what that means. And it will have... It will be... It has a strange status on its end. Good. Okay, so paragraph 9, 3 3/4 interpretations of it. So now you know what I do with my weekends, right? I cook up these insane ideas. So, look at the title, investigation of the question, whether in a judgment of taste, the feeling of pleasure precedes the judging of the object, or the judging precedes. Do you have the misprint as well? Yeah, very good. It's the key is to understand it's the preceding judgment. Don't tell anyone. Obviously, no one at Hackett Publishing has noticed. They keep publishing it over and over again. All right, this is the very question about sensation I have already just put to you 2 minutes ago. And Kant says getting clear about this is getting clear about that this is the key to the critique of taste, and hence deserves full attention. So up to now, we've only been giving partial attention to what he says. So he's saying, we're nodding off. Okay, wake up, come on. Now we're going to get serious. He knows he's not the easiest read. So he says in the first paragraph, pretty much what I said to you 5 minutes ago. He says, and one of the things behind this is in this relationship between whether the judgment or the pleasure comes first, is what it means to take a Copernican turn in aesthetics. If the sensation comes first, then Kant is a realist. As Hume is in the judgment of taste, right? What's that key to the judgment of taste in Hume at the end of the barrel of wine? There's a key! That actually is, I had this taste. Ooh, it tasted, a bit like, iron and brass, and a bit of leathery kind of wine. And then at the bottom, oh, look, there's a key on a thong, on a leather thong. Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it really was just a causal judgment, right? So in that sense, in Hume, the judgment of taste is actually, right, assimilating the judger to the causal properties of the object. Right? That's why there's something odd. I mean, that simplifies Hume's essay on the judgment on taste. But nonetheless, that is the key moment, and it's exactly non-Copernican. So in turning things around, making the judgment precede the pleasure, we're doing the Copernican turn. But so he claims that if you have the sensation first, no matter how you play it, you're going to end up with agreeableness, not taste. Agreeableness and pleasure, the sensation is agreeable. So you must, he says, in the second paragraph, he says that if the pleasure comes first, then the judgment is causal. Hence, weirdly, And you have to get the weirdness of it, and living with this weirdness is the hardest thing. Somehow, the judgment grounds the pleasure. Although we already know that what makes a judgment aesthetic is what? Is this the essential pleasure we take in it? So we seem to have conflicting requirements, right? On the one hand, he's already told us that it's not based on a concept, it has to be based on pleasure. But then he says if we base on pleasure in some naive way, right, we're going to end up as causalists, the Humeans, and just be reporting causal facts about the world, really, and therefore not speaking with a universal voice except in a purely causal way, and not normative at all. Loses all normativity, all notion of rightness, and the notion of taste really, in a way, drops out of the empiricist picture. So if we want, if so far we've been compelling about the first moments we've looked at, namely the disinterestedness of the pleasure, which already takes it out of the causal realm, and we agree with the logical grammar of universality, then he says the only alternative is to say the judgment grounds the pleasure. So that's what we need to understand. But as Allison points out, when he then begins the third paragraph, the argument turns brutally circular. He says, hence, it must be the universal communicability of the mental state in the given presentation which underlies the judgment of taste as its subjective condition, and the pleasure in the object must be its consequence. So now the claim appears to be that the pleasure of taste is the result of the very universal communicability of the mental state itself. And of course, we're assuming that this universally communicable mental state is presumably itself pleasurable. And that, as Allison rightly comments, commits Kant to the view that pleasure of taste must be the universal communicability of the pleasure of taste. And that seems hopelessly circular. Okay. Now we have a puzzle. So now we need interpretation. And now I'm going to give you like a Fellini, what's that Fellini?
Eight and a half.
Eight and a half. I'm going to give you 3 3/4. Well, there are two dominant versions of the argument. I mean, there are 2 3/4 interpretations that argue that there is one pleasure, and they have different interpretations of what that one pleasure is. And then we're going to have as the third interpretation, a two-pleasure theory. Okay. So I can see you're all just baffled, but it will get clear. This is Grace, I think, was worrying about this a couple of weeks ago, yeah? Okay, we're up to the hunt moment. Okay. The first interpretation, which is owed to Paul Bouyer, says that judgments of taste involve 2 distinct acts. 2 different kinds of acts and their relationship. The first act we'll simply call the judging the object. And we can call this moment of judging the object an act of aesthetic response. And here, just to give you, remind you of the picture we were doing, we have the object, and the judging of the object is the business of generating a relationship. This is what the aesthetic response is, of the relationship between the imagination and the understanding. That is, I reflect upon the object, and I do all the stuff I've talked about before, looking to see if there is a complicated unity in multiplicity. And the idea of unity in multiplicity without a rule. So the demand for unity is the demand of the understanding that we do it without the rule means that the imagination is doing this act of reflecting, which is also synthesizing, right, in a ruleless way, that is merely through what I call apprehension. If, now, I am successful, if I find this unity in multiplicity, which is the harmony of imagination and understanding, and I'm going to give you three interpretations of imagination and understanding next week, what the harmony is. I know you're baffled about that. We got lots to talk about that too. For the now, just we know it's just unity and multiplicity. If we're successful, then we have bingo, or what we call pleasure. And that is all of this. All of this is Act One. This is just a work of aesthetic reflection. Well, what more do I need for a judgment of taste? Well, according to Guire, I need a second act, which we're going to call the... We'll just hold the judgment of taste proper. Those Heideggerians would hate the word proper. Tough luck. And this is not an aesthetic response, but an aesthetic judgment. Well, what is there to do in this aesthetic judgment? Well, what, and Guire, of course, assumes, everyone assumes, Malcolm Budd, who has a similar theory, assumes, Anthony Saville, who has a similar theory, assumes, that this is not explicit, but implicit kind of mental activity. What this second bit, second act does is, first of all, notice the pleasure derived in Act One. So it's a reflective act. So it really is an act about reflecting on the first act. So the second act is a reflective almost analysis of the first act. And it says, whoa, I've noticed that there is a pleasure. And when I think about that pleasure, when I look inside myself, I discover that it does not derive from my thinking about anything I desire. It does not have to do with any of my moral drives. It does not seem to relate to anything distinctive of me. And indeed, I'm bound to say it seems to be about nothing other than the harmony of the imagination and understanding in their free play. So because I find that there are no concepts involved, because I find that there are no desires involved, because I take the state I'm in to be disinterested, and because finally, looking forward a little bit, because I recognize that I am responding merely to the form of the object, the purposiveness without purpose of it, that I'm not attending to anything substantial but to its form, I therefore judge that this is an aesthetic response, and therefore I take my judgment to be one of taste, not of anything else, and therefore I judge the object beautiful. So the second act is the subject making the entire first act her object, and saying of that first act that it satisfies all the criteria of disinterestedness, purposes without purpose, etc., etc., and therefore X is beautiful. So the actual judgment, X is beautiful, is a judgment about my aesthetic response to the object. The aesthetic judgment proper is a judgment about my first order aesthetic response. And it claims because it meets all the desideratum, then I'm entitled to say the object is beautiful. And in saying that, I am speaking with a universal voice. Yeah? Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's why I say it's implicit. It can be very quick. This is really trying to tease out moments in a what can feel like a univocal process for Guire. Okay. Well, at least Kant thinks that's not true. and one of the, it's almost become a philosophical sport showing why Guire is wrong about this. And in his most recent writings, he says, I still think I'm right, but now I think was I missing her first name? It's not Melissa Zucker. It's Rachel Zucker. I think Rachel Zucker has a criticism of me that may be right. Rachel Zucker has a terrific book coming out on the... Is it out yet?
I think so.
Like today? Yeah. Well, I haven't seen it yet. Okay. I've just seen bits of it. But a terrific book that emphasizes the second part of the third critique. So it's going to be a very, very important addition
on teleology.
Yeah. And Rachel's a student of Paul Pippin's and a terrific young philosopher. Okay, well, but I don't want to go through everyone's critique of Guire. Kant seems to me sufficient. So in the first introduction in section 9, pages 238, 239, Kant says, if we grant the claim of a judgment to necessity, it would be preposterous to justify it by explaining psychologically the origin of the judgment. That is, he says, we can't get necessity by saying, we've got, this would be the necessity, and here would be the origin of it, namely a psychological state of affairs where I'm in this state of harmonizing my imagination and understanding. So, Kant goes on, for we would thereby act against our own intention, and if the look for explanation were to succeed completely, it would show that the judgment can make absolutely no claim to necessity precisely because it can prove its empirical origin. That is, necessity, normative necessity drops out because all the weight is being done by the psychological harmony of the faculties in step one. But then, and the point here is that now aesthetic judgments of reflection, Kant goes on, are of this kind. They make a claim to necessity and say that not that everyone judges this way. In that case, their explanation would be the task for empirical psychology, but that everyone ought to judge this way. In other words, what Weyer's account does, and he's quite open about it, is make the normativity into an ideal prediction. Not of what... So he treats the idea of eliminating interests and things like that as a way of getting the right psychological pedigree. And if the pedigree is right, if I'm right about the psychological characteristics in my second-order judgment, then I really do expect, would be the better word, everyone who is similarly placed to judge in the same way. In short, the two-act theory, with only one moment of pleasure, in A, turns out to lose all the actual normativity of Kant's account. Okay. That's interpretation one. It is, although wrong, as we'll see, we can't quite just shuffle it off. Even wrong theories tend to come back in nasty ways. The second interpretation belongs to Hannah Ginsborg, and she first proffered it in a single essay called On the Key to Kant's Critique of Taste, which appeared in the Pacific Philosophical Quarterly in 1991. And just as an aside, as an object lesson to you all, Hannah is a professor of philosophy at Berkeley, and she has built her entire career on thinking out the implications of paragraph 9 of the Critique of Judgment. Getting it right, reading the rest of the text, and as I'll suggest later today, then showing how it feeds back into the first critique, is a way, so you don't have to know everything to make absolutely fundamental contributions to philosophy. Getting something right helps. Right? And Hannah's been absolutely dogged about this. Right? I mean, it's just, so, you know, drive me nuts. I just couldn't do it temperamentally, right? You know, I get bored reading anything, right? I want to go on to the next thing. Nonetheless, she has developed a fascinating interpretation. And she, too, thinks there's just one pleasure. But on her account, this is a self-grounding pleasure. So she wants to take literally the case, what Kant, we've already read Kant as saying. She wants it to be the case, just to repeat Kant's phrasing, that the universal capacity for being communicated of the mental state in the given representation as a subjective condition of judgment of taste must serve as its ground. and must have the pleasure in the object as its consequence. So it is the universal communicability of being in that state that is the source of my pleasure, and is the ground, therefore, of my pleasure in the object. This is called, for reasons that should be obvious, a self-referential theory of judgment. That is, what is the aesthetic theory of judgment about? It's about aesthetic judging. That the object becomes almost irrelevant here, and I'll come back to that fact. That's what's wrong with it. But it really is, the pleasure is in being in that kind of state. And this does have, as I'll suggest later, tremendous potentialities for explaining other phenomena. So the theory, as she puts it, is to say that in perceiving an object, I take my mental state to be universally communicable. That's the primary doctrine. That in my experience, as it were, my experience is, as I am judging, I want to say, huh, I am judging this object as it ought to be judged by everyone. That's the primitive act. So, in this case, my mental state is nothing other than the state of performing the act of judging. That is, the act of saying, I am judging this object as it ought to be judged by everyone. Right? That is my judgment. That is it. So it's as if, to put it another way, what Guire thinks of B kind of detaches itself from A and makes itself the whole story. So in addition, Ginsburg says, let us suppose that in performing this act of judgment, so now this is kind of crazy. So she has a problem. Why is it crazy? Because when I make an aesthetic judgment, I don't think I'm making a judgment about my own mental state. I think I'm talking about the goddamn Matisse. So she needs to give us at least a little story about how, you know, the ordinary phenomenology of this works out. And she says, in addition, let us suppose that in performing this act of judgment, I am not explicitly aware of its self-referential structure, but that my act of judgment is instead manifest to consciousness. Well, how is it manifest to consciousness? In being in a state of pleasure. That's how it's manifest to consciousness, just as Kant says. In other words, the act of self-referentiality, of self-referentially taking my mental state to be universally communicable with respect to the given object, consists phenomenologically in a feeling of pleasure in that object. Nonetheless, I want to do just underline. Nonetheless, the exercise of taste is nothing but the act of self-referentially judging that one's mental state in that very act of judging is universally communicable, and that this act of judgment is manifest to consciousness as a feeling of pleasure. Hence, we get it exactly as Kant demands. Namely, the judgment precedes the pleasure. That's what we wanted, after all. But it's now not this mere aesthetic response that precedes the pleasure, but this judging my state to be universally communicable that precedes the pleasure. But it becomes manifest to consciousness in pleasure. That is, it is the source of the pleasure, but that source only becomes manifest via the pleasure. Hence, at the same time, the act of judging one's feeling of pleasure to be universally valid goes through. Okay, so one further thought here. What does this say about pleasure? And it's very important. Because this answers a question that some of you have been puzzling over. One of the things we've been puzzling over is, what on earth is disinterested pleasure? Ginsburg now gives us an emphatic answer. She says, in engaging in this self-referential act of judgment, what I am doing, in effect, is demanding that all other judges perceive the object as I do, and thus they all ought to share the mental state that corresponds to my act of judging. That's kind of obvious. But here's the unobvious twist. But this demand of being a universal applies just as much to me as to everyone else. That is, in making this judgment, I am saying that I am judging this object as I ought to be judging it. Now, if I'm judging it as I ought normatively to be judging it, then it follows. In that sense, what I can see Tom's puzzled. What I'm saying here is that if you demand that everyone judge as you do, then the next step is to put yourself in that universal group of everyone else. Right? You're just one in that universal community that ought to judge it like that. Right? You're not anyone apart from that group. You're just a member of it. So you too ought to be judging it as you are in fact judging it. That is, you are living up to the normative requirements of your own judgment. But if that's the case, then I take it that I myself, like any other perceiver of the object, ought to be in the mental state corresponding to the mental state I am in. So I am normatizing, right? I mean, this is real self-referentiality, right? I am in the mental state I ought to be in. So I am corresponding to my own normative requirements, and it is therefore that my pleasure is disinterested. It's the universality that grounds the disinterestedness rather than the disinterestedness grounding the universality. So you've really got an absolutely Copernican structure, absolutely through. No. You're fully engaged because you're judging it exactly how you ought to be judging it.
Oh, so he takes us away. It seems like there's a third term involved that takes precedence over the object.
No, it is... Huh. What is it? What I'm going to say is it's kick-starting normativity out of itself. This is saying that there's no ground to our normativity. Our normativity arises from our taking our judgments to be universal and nothing else. And I'm going to explain in the second half why you can actually get a theory of concept acquisition on this basis. Because I'm going to explain the possibility of universality generally on a Ginsburgian analysis. So the thought here is you want, here's why you said what you did, and why this is staggeringly uncomfortable. You think there should be a source for normativity. Where would that be? To think there should be a source for normativity is to be in plainness. If there's no source for normativity other than be taking our judgments to be as they ought to be, then the aesthetic judgment is performing the normativity of normativity. That is, it is saying, this is what it means to judge universally and nothing else. Now all the hands.
This is still normativity with prescriptivity.
Yes and no.
I mean, it seems like you're disavowing.
You're not disavowing. What you're doing is, I mean, after all, again, you're not prescriptively requiring. You are. The notion of requirement, I mean, the difficulty is moral requirements have, here's why, and I'll say something about it. For one thing, and I'll have to say more about this next week, but here's why it's not going to be quite moral, that this kind of normativity is tied up with factuality at the same time. That is, it stands uncomfortably between normative moral type states and cognitive reflective type states. It's not pure normativity, right? And it's pure normativity that then gets you into how do I want to put it? It's an attempt to bond factuality and normativity. Right? It's trying to, as it were, find exactly how a factical state of affairs can take on normative force without that normative force being anything other than your relationship to this. So that there's, now, what I will say, just to help you out, is there's a way of thinking about this that is a way of getting rid of moral normativity. Okay? Because what makes moral normativity moral, just so we get our terms done, is its overridingness. That is what for Plato, for Kant, for moral rationalism, what makes the moral ought moral is it overrides every other possible judgment, state of affairs, desire, anything in the life. And they think that overridingness is necessary for morality. And the reason they think overridingness is necessary for morality is because if you lack overridingness, then you lack obligatoriness. Now, in a book called The Dawn of Disenchantment, it has been argued that we do not need overridingness for morality, that all of morality that we have is a mistake. But the key to finding out what that mistake is staying with this stuff. So can we find another notion of normativity that is normative without moral overridingness? That's the interest of this. Okay? So I'm not saying it's not prescriptive. Of course, I'm saying you censure, you demand, And that's why you're saying, come on. I mean, your art has to have certain real... Yeah, it's got to be a little bit oddish, but it's not morally oddish, because it can't be overriding. Okay, so I know you've been dying here.
I'm wondering, the way in which you sort of give an account of Ginsberg, it seems like there's a missing element, and the way in which you've presented it, it seems as if universal communicability is the source for pleasure. But the problem,
that's what she said.
Okay, so that's what you're saying. That's got to be too general, because we can talk about universally communicable states in which there is no pleasure, so the missing component has to be something about the kind of state this is, which ought not to seem universally communicable, but nonetheless is. So, because of...
Why that? I mean, I was happy up till then.
Okay, I say in part because the ways in which concepts aren't involved.
Ah, right. Right. So she has to add some other stuff in.
Right.
So there are missing steps, and that's right. And she tries to build them in. The difficulty for her is if she builds them in too well, she begins to creep back up here. Right? And she doesn't want to do that. So she wants it, but she does want it to be non-conceptual. That's a premise here. Yeah? Karen?
At this point in the second moment you can prove this and possibly jump ahead to the fourth moment, or what the difference between the second moment and the fourth moment is.
Great. Okay. So that's going to be, you've already got the three-quarters interpretation, which is to say he can prove it here. He's going to need to do it later, which is exactly what Allison says. So I'm going to come to that in a moment. But that's exactly why Allison's interpretation is a three-quarter interpretation, because he thinks you need to say a whole lot more to talk about this moment, and therefore, and that only happens in the fourth moment, which is the quid iuris. So your intuitions are absolutely spot on. The rest of you, I know that's confusing. I'll explain it in a moment, but I'll come back to it. Yeah.
One more question then about Ginsberg's particular interpretation. Yeah. Even if we buy Gabe's objection that she's got to give us something to show us that this is specifically aesthetic,
right.
I'm not seeing how she's going to avoid collapsing beautiful into ugly. So that's to say...
No, just the opposite.
Just the opposite.
Just the opposite. If it's just this, how on earth is a judgment of ugly going to be possible?
Because if I'm judging the object the way it should be judged, which is to say I'm judging it beautiful or ugly.
But it has to be the harmony of the faculties, right? So she's saying that my mental state is as it ought to be, that is, in this harmonious state. So her problem is just the opposite. She can't actually, there's not enough of A. This is one objection to her. This is, in fact, both of you are really spot on. That's the second bit of Allison's objection, that she can't make sense of the ugly. I'll explain that again in a minute. Okay, let me just say a few words, and then we'll have a break. Maybe just paragraph 9 today. Who knows? So everyone's gutting on that something's deeply uncomfortable about this. Because in this case, the judgment of taste is essentially about and a pleasure in its own normativity, which is kind of curious. That is, the self-inferentiality seems so excessive. And that really means there are at least three criticisms, and maybe more, the more being what Matt and Karen have already suggested. And the three criticisms are as follows. First, it seems to lose the role of the object in a substantial way. And indeed, Ginsberg seems to acknowledge this on page 308 and seems oddly undisturbed by it. She says, on my account, the free play of the faculties bears no essential relation to the activities of ordering and unifying. All that stuff. That's the reflecting, the ordering and unifying. Whereby we make sense of an object of aesthetic experience. If it captures anything about the phenomenology of aesthetic experience, it is only this. The experience of an object as beautiful carries with it the sense of its own universal validity, and hence of its rightness or appropriateness with respect to the object perceived. So she says, yeah, it does kind of lose the depth of any notion of reflection. And she even says, she tries to defend herself, but she says, it essentially seems devoid of content, which is part of your worry, right? Because it has so little reference to the object. So something about this seems powerful, but something about it seems overly self-referential. It's as a Copernican turn, but the world itself gets lost in the meanwhile. Which is always, by the way, a worry about Kant, right? People are always worried that somehow the world gets absorbed, right? And that he's a subjective idealist. The second objection is the one I've just issued. If it is this, I'm in the state I ought to be in, it doesn't seem to leave room for negative judgments of taste. And third, and here's just a question, but I take it it's Tom's question, so we'll call it Tom's question. Has Ginsburg deprived, she thinks she's grounded disinterestedness in universality. But if the pleasure is pleasure in universal communicability, isn't that an interested pleasure? Almost moral? Now, about that one, I don't know how to judge. I ask that as a question. You could take exactly the opposite view and say she's lost the notion of disinterested pleasure and made it an interest in universal communicability and the formation, ultimately, of a sensus communis. And maybe that's what Kant should have said. It's even maybe what he did say. But then this stuff about disinterestedness needs to be very, very vitiated. I mean, it has to be very thin indeed. Because all it comes down to is the claim that it doesn't derive from the desires of the body, nor does it derive from an interest in the good. It actually comes about through a new interest. Say, the interest in the sensus communis. Whatever that is. Okay. Let's take a break right there, because it's already 9:15. And I can see you're probably just thinking this can't go on too much longer, can it? It can, but we'll have a break anyway.